Hey friends, this episode of The Fellow on Call is not meant to be used for medical advice and is intended for educational purposes only. Patient information has been modified to ensure privacy. The views expressed in this episode do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers. Enjoy!
Welcome to another episode of The Fellow on Call, the Hemonc Podcast. We're coming at you from Reloy University Medical Center. I'm Ronak.
I'm Vivek.
And I'm Dan.
And in today's episode, we once again continue our CLL journey, this time turning our attention to that relapse setting. Guys, I think the conversations so far have been really great. I mean, I think we all agree that we see CLL quite a bit in our clinics, and it's always a little bit uncomfortable, especially in the beginning, deciding who do we treat, who do we not treat, especially when people are walking in with these super high white counts that gets a lot of people nervous. And I think that I spend a lot of time with my CLL patients that are not yet on treatment, essentially on that counseling portion. I think it's been really helpful to kind of go through the thought process about when do we provide treatment, when do we not provide treatment, and at the very least, it's great for being able for us to educate our patients better.
Yeah, it's been a great series so far. I'm obviously biased because I like this topic. And we're going to recap again some of these fundamental concepts of risk stratification, when to treat, what these treatment options are as we get into this relapse discussion today.
I'm happy we're here at the relapse discussion because for a disease like CLL, you know, for the overwhelming majority of patients that you do end up treating, you may have to look at next line therapies too. So I'm glad we're getting into this.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Well, without further ado, let's roll that show. You guys, before we jump into today's episode on CLL, I was just curious. I don't think we've ever talked about what our favorite movies were growing up as kids. What was your go-to?
I'll start us off. This is probably not good. My parents probably don't want me to say this, but I did watch Gladiator when I was a kid. And man, it was an excellent movie. So I think I would go with Gladiator. But if we're going for family-friendly movies, I would say The Goonies. So Gladiator and The Goonies. But Gladiator, man, Russell Crowe. And they're making a new one now, which is, I don't know how I feel about that. Because Russell Crowe, you know, spoiler alert, who everyone who listens to this should have seen Gladiator at this point, but, you know, he's not alive. So I don't know how you can do Gladiator without him, but I would say those are my two movies.
Maybe it's like a prequel.
No, it's after. It's after. It doesn't make any sense.
Oh, no.
It makes no sense.
It's a zombie movie. I think I was a big Land Before Time kid, I want to say. I don't know that I watched like all 12 of them or whatever, because eventually you're just going to get to like time. But yeah, that was probably that or 101 Dalmatians. I remember really liking that movie too. Beautifully animated.
Beautifully animated indeed. Everyone knows I'm a big Harry Potter fan, so I would definitely say Harry Potter. But I think, again, going for more animated things I watched as a kid, I think Lion King, the original on VHS, was my favorite thing ever. I think I've watched that movie more times than I can count, which is awesome. It is a classic. The live action was not as good. The first Broadway play actually I ever saw was The Lion King because I love this movie so much. So also, y'all, if you haven't seen it, you should watch The Lion King. But I hope our listeners have at some point.
I probably should have said an animated movie. I am a normal person who does like animated movies as well, but Gladiator's just so good. It's just so good. Let's move on today to our case. So I'm going to kick us off with a case and we'll get into the discussion. So we have a 65-year-old female with CLL who presents for management discussion. Her labs were notable for a white count of 120,000, hemoglobin of 9, and platelets of 130. Differential showed predominant lymphocytosis. Her labs 6 months ago showed a white count of 40,000 with a normal hemoglobin and platelets. And so at that time, flow cytometry was done. That's how we made her diagnosis, which showed an abnormal monotypic B-cell population that was CD5 positive, CD19 bright, CD20 dim, and CD200 bright, which was consistent with CLL. She had FISH at the time, which was notable for a deletion 17P, and she had an IGHV that was unmutated. We had planned for this surveillance option. She had noticed increasing right neck adenopathy now at her visit. She's been talking about this. She's had progressive fatigue with intermittent drenching night sweats and now has a 15-pound unintentional weight loss over the past 6 months. So we discussed treatment indications last week and the general outline for frontline treatment. Before we get into our relapse discussion, can one of you recap the prognostication for these patients and why we get that FISH and IGHV mutation status?
Absolutely. Peripheral blood testing, we know, is sufficient for diagnosis. There's plenty of these cells around to make the diagnosis off of. That's kind of the whole problem. And flow cytometry really helps identify that classic phenotype for CLL cells. And then we can also send a FISH test on the CLL panel for additional details on what FISH is and all that. You can go back to our HemePath series, some great stuff back there. In addition, you can send molecular testing for IGHV mutation status, the immunoglobulin heavy chain mutation. As far as prognostication, first looked at that pivotal study in the year 2000 by Doner and colleagues. Was the first thing to look at FISH for prognostication. The three big ones to remember are 13q deletion, 11q deletion, and 17p deletion. 13q, if that's the only abnormality on the FISH panel, that's a favorable prognosis. That's the most favorable prognosis of all. 11q deletion was found to be unfavorable for a subset of younger patients. Deletion 17P, and remember, 17P is where that P53 gene is located, so it's essentially like a P53 deletion. 17P deletion is the most unfavorable, so that is the worst prognosis. Everything else that you could find there is kind of like intermediate, including no abnormalities. Further study of that 11Q deletion found that it's not quite as unfavorable as we previously thought, especially when looking at other prognostic characteristics. And we discussed that in our last episode as well. But it's still good to know about that deletion in general because it's used as a risk stratification factor in planning clinical trials or CLL. For IGHV status, remember that IGHV unmutated patients have a worse prognosis. That's because this basically represents a more naive B cell. It's an earlier, less mature B cell that has not yet undergone that somatic hypermutation process in the germinal center.
These concepts are really critical to understand, especially when you get a newly diagnosed patient, why we order these tests. And I often see referrals where the IGHV mutation status wasn't sent, and it's still very critical to know. So remember from our first CLL episode, we talked about the Rye stage and Binet stage, which were developed in the 1970s. We're not going to recap that. And they're probably not quite as relevant for survival prediction in the modern era, but can be used as a whole with these other prognostication factors. So Rona, can you tell us more about the indications for treatment?
Yeah, and we talked about this in the last couple of episodes too, but just to remind you all, we treat if our patients have one of the following criteria in general. So if they have anemia and or thrombocytopenia related to CLL infiltration of the bone marrow, if they have recurrent autoimmune cytopenias related to CLL after initial treatment with steroids and rituximab, and throwback to last episode where we talked about Vivek's patient, who initially had presented with hemolysis concerning for a warm autoimmune hemolytic anemia, ultimately found to have CLL, but we were able to defer treatment because it was the first time that he had his autoimmune cytopenia related to CLL, and he did respond to steroids and rituximab. So again, anemia or thrombocytopenia related to CLL, recurrent autoimmune cytopenias, B symptoms or symptomatic lymphadenopathy, and then a lymphocyte doubling time of less than 6 months. Remember, this one is a little bit more ambiguous. Some people use this and weigh this a little less heavily, but nonetheless, just something to consider. Remember that asymptomatic patients can be observed and have no contraindications to any procedures or operations, and you don't need to treat patients just because they have a lymphocytosis. Patients can have white counts of upwards of 100,000 without any symptoms, and it's okay to observe. And we are not worried about leukostasis in the same way that we would be, for instance, in an acute leukemia patient.
I think all those things are really, really important to know when we think about when do we treat these patients. And our patient here, she didn't have any of those things. We opted for observation, knowing she was higher risk. We had that conversation. Hey, look, it's likely you're going to need treatment potentially in the next few months to a few years, right? That said, these 17p deletion patients aren't going to go long term without requiring some form of therapy, typically within months to years. So keep in mind, we didn't do a bone marrow biopsy on this patient. Whether to do a bone marrow biopsy or not in all CLL patients is up for debate, so we won't talk about that. We've already discussed that in a previous episode. And we initially didn't get staging imaging because she was asymptomatic, right? You're going to get that at the time you're about to start treatment. So she's now coming in with these symptoms and these cytopenias. How do you guys approach imaging, and how do you approach first-line therapy for these patients?
And remember that when it comes to risk stratification, we're not treating these higher risk patients up front because it doesn't change the overall trajectory of disease based on that CLL12 trial where we basically randomized patients to either ibrutinib or placebo based on those high risk features. They found a time to next treatment benefit, which is fine, but no overall survival benefit. And that's really where the good stuff is. And this confirmed that watchful waiting currently is our standard of care. That's why we ended up observing this patient, but now she does need therapy. This is a point at which it's critical to get PET CT or plain CT, alternatively, to look for nodal disease burden. An excisional lymph node biopsy would be a good next step if you do find sort of enlarged nodes, just to rule out a Richter's transformation. And this is part of the reason why PET can be a little bit more informative, especially if you have a particularly avid node on PET CT, that can be a good target to go for biopsy.
I really think that's critically important. There was actually data, and we'll link this to our show notes, that patients who have Richter's transformation, their SUV uptake on the PET scan will be median of about 15, whereas those who did not have Richter's transformation will be an SUV around 7. So you can see how that PET scan avidity, that SUV number, really makes a difference and really raises your suspicion for something like a Richter's transformation. And so going along the lines of this patient, let's say she didn't have Richter's transformation, what are you going to counsel her? How are you going to choose first-line therapy? And we talked about it last week, but let's recap it again.
Our first-line treatment is actually pretty simple. We essentially have two options these days. We can do a fixed duration therapy or an indefinite therapy. For fixed duration therapy, we're looking at obinutuzumab plus venetoclax. And for indefinite, BTK, brutin tyrosine kinase inhibitor, either acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib these days. That's combined with 6 months of obinutuzumab as well to give a little boost right up front. But again, that BTK inhibitor is continued indefinitely. I do always mention that for the first option, the limited duration treatment, there are really frequent lab checks and visits required just because we're given a fairly intensive therapy for that first couple of months. But for some people, they might find it a better fit if they'd rather just get a bunch of treatment right up front and then not have to worry about taking a pill every day thereafter. For patients with deletion 17p or a TP53 mutation, we generally know that those folks are going to be more chemotherapy resistant. We're really happy to have these treatment options, these more targeted treatment options that still work well for that population.
So Vivek, if I can assume the case for a second and ask a question as a follow-up. Let's say we presented all these options to our patient. She ultimately opted for a fixed duration therapy with obinutuzumab and venetoclax. I think we've alluded to this before, but just in case we haven't, and Dan was sort of alluding to this, we worry about lab abnormalities, especially with venetoclax. And the big thing that we worry about is tumor lysis syndrome, especially during that ramp up period. So as someone that has taken care of a lot of patients with CLL, when do you decide to admit patients for things like hydration and TLS monitoring? Is it ever okay to do this as an outpatient? How do you go about that?
Yeah, this is a great question. And it's really clinical experience and provider dependent. And I think if you're not comfortable with it or haven't seen a lot of these patients, it's going back to that trial that got obinutuzumab venetoclax approved and saying, what did they do in the trial? You know, how did they define high-risk patients for tumor lysis syndrome and who got admitted to the hospital for continuous hydration? So at baseline, every single patient's going to get put on allopurinol, and we tell them to drink a lot of water. We say, hey, look, drink 1.5-2 liters of water a day. You need to keep your health self hydrated, particularly when you're on this chemo pill, because it kills your cancer so quickly, right? And we don't want to hurt your kidneys and have these electrolyte imbalances. And we tell all of our patients this. And really, they're really good at following that recommendation. But who are these high-risk patients? What they did in the trial is they said, if you have a lymph node that's greater than 10 centimeters, that's high risk. That person needs to be admitted. Continuous hydration, watch them very closely for tumor lysis syndrome. The other definition of high risk was an absolute lymphocyte count of greater than 25,000 and a lymph node that was somewhere between 5 to 10 centimeters. And so both of those scenarios, I have a lymph node greater than 10, or I have lymph node between 5 and 10, but also a high white count of over 25,000 lymphocytes. They were also considered to be admitted. Here's the good thing about the way this treatment regimen is set up. You get weekly obinutuzumab for 3 doses before you start the venetoclax ramp up. And many of our patients' white counts that started off greater than 25,000, they drop quick. I mean, they drop below that 25,000 mark. They go from that high risk group down to more of a medium risk group. So it's not common that we have to admit these patients to the hospital for this tumor lysis monitoring. We can keep them as an outpatient, do weekly to twice weekly labs on them just to make sure they're good and provide hydration, typically in the outpatient setting if needed. We often don't need to admit these people to the hospital, which has been really good for patients who have CLL getting obinutuzumab venetoclax. But it does require, again, this frequent coming in and this frequent lab monitoring for that reason.
So our patient completed monthly obinutuzumab for cycles 2 through 6 and venetoclax through cycle 12. She had CT imaging after cycle 6, which showed a CR of her lymph nodes, and she has completed treatment at this point and has normal counts. The imaging at the end of treatment showed ongoing CR, and we're planning to monitor her with labs and exam every 3 months. Over that time, she continued to do well. We checked labs for every 4 months for a few years. Then she developed an asymptomatic rising white count. She's at this point 4 years out from that first line therapy with venetoclax and obinutuzumab. Her white count is around 130,000, and she's developing new anemia that we don't have another good explanation for, with hemoglobin of 9.3. She's having progressive fatigue. Otherwise, though, she doesn't have really any complaints. Now that we have this patient who's relapsed and has developed a cytopenia, how would you approach her? What's your next step in working her up for potential next lines of therapy?
So I think regardless of the initial treatment strategy, it's important that, as has been with many different types of cancers we talk about, we restage our patients, right? We want to see what the status of their disease is, and ideally we'll be able to do this with the PET scan. So the benefit of the PET in this case is that you have that information about, are there any enlarged lymph nodes? The same things that we were saying in our initial approach to treatment discussion. And this way we can figure out, are there any of those AVID lymph nodes that we can then biopsy, with the idea of this Richter's transformation that we keep alluding to in the back of our minds. That's really what we're worried about, is wanting to ensure, is this patient having CLL again, or has this converted to a more aggressive form of lymphoma? Another thing that can happen in patients is that some patients with CLL will transform to a pro-lymphocytic leukemia, which also has a poor prognosis. So that's the other thing that we're on the lookout for. These transformation events represent a clonal evolution in most cases, right? You have this subclone, this population that was resistant to the initial treatments that were administered, that has now grown and progressed. And so that is likely what's driving the recurrence of this disease. So for relapsed CLL, you just do the treatment opposite of what you did in the frontline. So in this case, our patient had opted for obinutuzumab and venetoclax in the frontline setting. And luckily, with the availability of so many more treatment options, we can offer her a BTK inhibitor as her second line option.
So our patient, her restaging imaging did not have any concerning AVID adenopathy. We started her on acalabrutinib, 100 milligrams BID. And so what's the data behind the use of BTK inhibitors in this population in the relapse setting?
Yeah, I'll walk us through, and we'll have details in our show notes, of three trials for the BTK inhibitors. Trial number one was called Resonate, and this trial compared ibrutinib to a monoclonal CD20 antibody that nobody has probably heard of if you're training right now, which is called ofatumumab. Like, you know, who uses ofatumumab? So this one ended up failing for a lot of different reasons, but regardless, very weak comparator arm, but still, ibrutinib won by a landslide. This resulted in a BTK inhibitor really becoming the standard of care in relapsed refractory CLL, because many of these patients got something like a chemoimmunotherapy with FCR or BR in the frontline setting. The problem was that ibrutinib resulted in AFib or A-flutter in about 12% of patients in that study. So at this point, companies were saying, wait, how do we develop BTK inhibitors that will cause less cardiac side effects? Let's have newer generation inhibitors that will have better toxicity profiles. And this is a good thing about me-too drugs. Sometimes me-too drugs are exactly the same without any benefit in toxicity. For the BTK inhibitor story, there was a benefit for toxicity, which I think is really important and really great that this happened. So there were two trials that compared the newer generation of BTK inhibitors to ibrutinib in the relapse refractory setting. One was for acalabrutinib called ELEVATE-RR. The other one was for zanubrutinib called ALPINE. Bottom line is this, there was, for the acalabrutinib trial, no difference at all in PFS or OS, and we halved the AFib, AFlutter events. So we're going from 10 to 15% down to like 5%. For the zanubrutinib trial, that ALPINE study, so it was designed for a non-inferiority and potential superiority of overall response rate, which is a ridiculous endpoint to choose. This is not a surrogate endpoint for CLL at all, but they decided to do it because they knew they were going to get the win there, maybe. I don't know why. It doesn't make any sense. But they did that, and they said, okay, it has better response rate. But that doesn't really tell me anything, right? Really, what I cared about was the toxicity profile. So we shouldn't say, well, zanubrutinib had a better overall response rate. And in fact, they did find a better PFS against ibrutinib in that study. So that means it's better than acalabrutinib. That just doesn't make any sense. We can't make that conclusion. But we know the same thing happened, where we about halved the rates of AFib and AFlutter. So both of these drugs are valid drugs to use, both acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib. There's no real major benefit to either one of these drugs, other than the fact that we have overall survival benefit in the frontline setting with obinutuzumab plus acalabrutinib. We don't have that with zanubrutinib. That doesn't mean zanubrutinib isn't good either. So long story short, The newer generations are better than ibrutinib, and this really worked well for patients with relapsed refractory BTK inhibitors, and it really led to a decrease in the use of things like allogeneic stem cell transplant for these patients, which we'll talk about here in a second.
Thanks for going through that, Vivek. That was a great discussion. And let's say in this case, our patient was to then start a calbrutinib, and she comes back to clinic a few weeks later and you check labs as you normally do, and you have this white count elevation in her baseline. Again, she's not symptomatic. She's not feeling anything from this. My instinct would be to sort of panic, like, what did I do? And so I had read about this lymphocyte flare that you can see with BTK inhibitors. Could you comment on that and why that happens, what that means, and do we need to do anything about that?
I actually encountered this in my first week of fellowship. This was one of the first patients I ever saw came in. They had just started a BTK inhibitor a couple weeks before with the fellow that handed off their panel to me, and I was a little freaked out. It's like, oh my God, their white count is higher. What's going on? Just some background on these BTK inhibitors. Ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib, they're all small molecules that irreversibly bind to BTK, Bruton's tyrosine kinase. And that is an essential part of the signaling pathway downstream of the B cell receptor. And CLL cell survival is driven through that B cell receptor signaling. So blocking this pathway leads to cell death by promoting apoptosis. After binding, these BTK inhibitors also cause a redistribution of those CLL cells residing in lymph nodes to the peripheral blood. So it's kind of like a demargination phenomenon. That leads to a shrinkage of the lymph nodes, but an increase in the overall lymphocyte count in the peripheral blood. It's just a transient phenomenon. Typically after a few months, that absolute lymphocyte count decreases. It sort of peaks after the first month and then goes down from there. But really it's just, now we're able to see a lot of these cells that were previously locked away in the lymph nodes.
It's like this redistribution effect, as you're saying. So it's not the disease is getting worse. It's just whatever was there is sort of shaking out the rug, for like lack of a better term. Let's say she does really well on acalabrutinib. Now it's been 5 years. Her counts have been looking good. And then all of a sudden she comes in to see you and her white count starts rising again. She's more anemic than she had been. So now one would argue that this may suggest that she's no longer responding to the BTK inhibitor. And so what do we do after BTK? She's already seen venetoclax. She's seen obinutuzumab. Where do we go from here?
That's a great question. And I want to highlight one more thing before we talk about this patient who's now refractory to both BTK inhibitors and venetoclax-based therapy. When we think about, let's pretend that our lady actually got acalabrutinib or some other BTK inhibitor in the frontline setting, and at relapse, we're saying, okay, let's do venetoclax. And you might be asking yourself, why obinutuzumab? And we talked last week about how obinutuzumab was found to show an overall survival benefit when combined with chemotherapy in an older trial. Check out that episode to refer back to that. But in this setting, actually in the relapsed refractory setting, our trial that we have for venetoclax is called Murano, and it compared venetoclax rituximab versus rituximab monotherapy. So no surprise there that venetoclax rituximab was the better choice and the winner of that. What we don't know is how much does obinutuzumab add in this setting. We just assume that it likely is very important. It's been shown time and time again in CLL to beat rituximab. And that's why we include venetoclax and obinutuzumab for these patients who are relapsed. I just want to touch on that very briefly. But to get back to this patient who's now very refractory to all of these treatments, if you have a fit patient, you consider allogeneic transplant for these patients. That's a curative treatment option for patients with CLL. It's not something that you think about a lot because you really think about the median age of diagnosis for these patients are in their 70s. There is going to be a patient that you encounter that's younger, that's a very fit patient, that has high-risk disease, typically this deletion 17p associated with this TP53 mutation. They blow through a couple lines of therapy and you're scratching your head thinking about, what do I do here? And you have to remember to refer that patient for an allogeneic transplant. That's really, really important. We know that the rates of allogeneic transplant increased probably around that 2008 to 2015-ish period. We saw a rise in the rates of allo transplant for these patients. And since then, as we've seen a subsequent decrease with the ongoing continued use and more frequent use of BTK inhibitors and venetoclax. But still, it's still an important treatment option today. One of the best retrospective studies to show how well these patients do was from the EBMT database, so the European Bone Marrow Transplant Database. And there's over 2,500 patients included retrospectively. And at 10 years, there was about a 35% overall survival. It was important to note that dying from just transplant-related causes in the long run was about 40%, that non-relapse mortality. So that's quite high, probably better now with improved transplant techniques. Relapse occurred in about 30% of people. So this is a toxic therapy. It's not something that you just want to say every TP53 mutated patient needs. That is not what we're saying. It's these refractory patients and you say, I've got nothing left. Maybe I've got a 30% shot at curing this patient. Unfortunately, CD19-directed CAR T-cell therapy, we've talked about CAR T-cell therapy in our large cell lymphoma episodes, doesn't really work as well for CLL patients. Now, though, okay, we say allotransplant, but not all of our patients can get an allogeneic transplant, or maybe they're in a donor search. We need to do something in the meantime. What treatment options do we have? We talked about covalent BTK inhibitors that Dan described and a little bit about their mechanism. There's now a non-covalent BTK inhibitor approved called pirtobrutinib. What happens is this Bruton's tyrosine kinase in that B-cell receptor, it develops this C481 mutation, which confers resistance to covalent BTK inhibitors. And this drug, pirtobrutinib, can overcome that resistance. So there was a phase 1-2 trial that included every patient had to have already seen a BTK inhibitor. It didn't matter if it was a ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, Zanu. They had to have seen a BTK inhibitor. About 40% had seen venetoclax, so you can say this isn't a completely refractory population, right? When we're talking about the response rates, I'm going to quote here, so keep that in mind. And about a quarter of them were just intolerant to the BTK inhibitor, which means their disease didn't progress through it. It meant maybe they got AFib, or maybe they couldn't tolerate, maybe they got hypertension, maybe they just got a rash. There's a lot of reasons why they stopped it. And I think that's really important when I talk about this response rate number. So when you talk to patients and you say, okay, I'm going to give you this drug, pirtobrutinib, well, in the study, the overall response rate was about 70% with a median PFS of 19 months. However, keep in mind, 40% got venetoclax, so it's probably not as high as that double refractory patient, and a quarter of them were just intolerant. So is the response rate 70%? Probably not. Is there activity? Absolutely. Is it a reasonable option in these patients? Definitely. And so that's why right now, pirtobrutinib would be the option to give for some of these patients.
Just to clarify there, so you're saying obviously this would be a potential treatment option for someone that isn't a transplant candidate, right, as next line therapy. But do you ever consider giving an agent like this to bridge somebody that may be an allo candidate? For instance, I have a younger patient who hopefully the day never comes, but should he ever progress, I think he'd be a great candidate for allo. Would this be something that you can give as sort of a bridging approach?
Yeah, definitely. I think this would be a perfect use for pirtobrutinib, is thinking about it as a bridging approach to allo transplant, but don't forget to make that allogeneic transplant referral.
So Vivek, I want to talk to you a little bit about something I haven't heard you mention yet, which is adalimumab. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but I'm pretty sure that's it. What are your thoughts on that? Is that an option? That's for CLL, right?
Idelalisib, whatever we want to call it, it's a very toxic drug. So this is a PI3 kinase inhibitor, super, super toxic. Been taken off the market voluntarily by the drug company after making $62 million, our good old healthcare system. $62 million profit and said, we're done now, no more, because we can't actually prove that we're better than standard of care therapies. This was approved in a trial that compared adalimumab, rituximab versus rituximab alone. And the rituximab alone arm crossed over to adalimumab, and adalimumab is so toxic that it probably led to mortality in some of those patients. So it's hard to know if this actually, giving this drug in general, has a survival decrement in some patients. Nonetheless, it has some activity. Do we like to use this drug? Absolutely not. And now that we have pirtobrutinib, I don't really think you're going to see adalimumab being used very frequently. It's going to be hard to get in general because the drug company's kind of throwing this in the trash can. But that's the story with that. There's a trial, we'll link it to our show notes, that kind of talked about this. Super toxic drug. If it's on your boards, then you can answer that question. But in reality, it causes pneumonitis, lots of hyperglycemia, pancreatitis, all these bad things that can happen with this drug. So super toxic, not something that we typically use in 2024.
Over the course of this episode and the last one, we keep mentioning or alluding to this other thing that can happen with CLL, Richter's transformation. And I know that in a disease that can cause super high white counts, bulky adenopathy, autoimmune cytopenias, all of this sort of strange things that can happen, I understand that this is sort of the most feared thing that can happen with CLL. Is that right?
The thing that took me a long time to wrap my head around is that Richter's transformation in CLL is very different than a large cell transformation for follicular lymphoma or marginal zone lymphoma. A Richter's transformation has a median overall survival in the current BTK inhibitor venetoclax era on the order of months. We're talking 6 months median overall survival. Very, very poor long-term outcomes. And you should consider an allogeneic transplant as consolidation if these patients get to a CR with standard large cell lymphoma chemotherapy. There's a lot of work done comparing regimens like R-CHOP plus venetoclax, all these new sort of chemotherapy combinations. In general, you treat the patient like you would a large cell lymphoma patient, and you take them and consolidate them with allogeneic transplant. That's how bad of a prognosis Richter's transformation is. It is nothing to be messing around with. The other thing about these patients with Richter's transformation is CAR T therapy, and we saw this at ASH 2023, has some promise for these patients, but overall survival, long-term cure is still looking at about 20%. So that can be an emerging treatment option. I think time will tell, and this is a very important area of research. It's a rare entity, but these patients do very, very poorly, and identifying it is critically important.
I think it's really interesting that even though it is a large cell lymphoma, unlike when we talked about DLBCL, where we would take patients to auto as in their relapse setting, we're taking them to allo in this setting. I think that's an important distinction to make, because I sort of just assume that it acts and behaves like any other DLBCL, large cell lymphoma sort of disease, but clearly that's not the case.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's the number one thing I want everyone to keep in mind is that Richter's transformation is a very, very bad prognosis. You need to discuss it at a tumor board, refer them to a tertiary academic center. Clinical trials are important. Whether to do an allo in consolidation or CAR T, that's an open area for debate. And all of these things are critically important for this really high-risk patient group.
I think this episode really brought home a lot of the important points that we've been bringing up throughout this series. And I think all this practical guidance, I think, is extremely helpful in figuring out what we're going to do with all this data. It is very evident that we don't have it exactly figured out with regards to what comes first, what comes second. But I love the concept of patient preference as being a big part of this. And it's good to know that the data suggests that even if you go with one option, there's still some efficacy with the other option in the second line and lower. So that's great. Guys, any final thoughts that you all have for this episode?
This is a great episode, and I'm excited. Our last episode of the series, we're going to talk about MRD-guided approaches. What if we did the kitchen sink up front? So I'm excited to talk about that in our next week.
Yeah, Vivek's grinning ear to ear, so he's going to really shed some important light on this concept. And we're seeing MRD testing being used more and more in the work that we do. So it's a great way for us to talk about a very relevant topic in amongst a lot of disease subtypes. All right, guys. Well, then I think that wraps up a fantastic show. So until next time, we'll see you all later.
See you later.
Peace.